This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at men's experiences of infertility and why we don't talk more about what it's like for men who are struggling to become dads. Now on Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up a two-day visit to Beijing, China. He met with President Xi Jinping and other Chinese government officials. The main official goal of the trip was to reestablish diplomacy and stability between the two countries. Blinken's the highest-level American official to visit China in nearly 5 years. Here he is talking to the press afterward.
Both the United States and China have an obligation to manage this relationship responsibly. Doing so serves the best interests of the United States, of China, indeed, of the world. We are clear-eyed about the challenges posed by the PRC. The United States will advance a vision for the future that we share with so many others, a free, open, stable, and prosperous world, with countries upholding and updating the rules-based order that has, for years, safeguarded peace and security globally. To shape that future, we start with diplomacy, including with China. I came to Beijing to strengthen high-level channels of communication, to make clear our positions and intentions in areas of disagreement, and to explore areas where we might work together when our interests align on shared transnational challenges. And we did all of that.
We're taking a look at that high-level visit and U.S.-China relations, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you hope that the U.S. Can cooperate, cool down tensions with China? What are some of the main areas of concern you have with either side of the relationship? What questions do you have about this Secretary of State's visit to China? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jing Sun is a professor of political science at the University of Denver. He received his PhD from UW-Madison. Jing, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you so much.
I don't think anybody thought, you know, this is going to be a magical solution to all the tensions between the U.S. and China. That said, what did both sides here, the Chinese leadership, Secretary of State Blinken, hope to accomplish with this visit?
Well, I think this is Antony Blinken's visit is certainly welcome news in the short run. So what it has done to the U.S.-China relations is it kind of halted the almost freefall of this most important bilateral relations in the world. And China and America got some attained some short-term goals through Antony Blinken's visit. But over the long term, I remain deeply concerned about the trajectory of Sino-U.S. relations.
What do you see as the biggest areas of concern for that relationship?
Well, it is still the issue about China and America on a path of a head-on collision, particularly over the issue of Taiwan. So this is the part where actually China got some, you know, short-term goal, you know, satisfied through Antony Blinken's visit. But in, you know, press conference, Blinken stated that America does not support Taiwan independence. That's exactly what Beijing wanted to hear from America's top diplomat. And in exchange for that, what America got from Beijing is China has finally agreed to talk, to resume this communication channel between the two countries. So in the wake of Antony Blinken's visit, what will happen next is we should expect a number of cabinet members from the Biden administration that will be headed for Beijing to have talks with their Chinese counterparts. Chinese Foreign Minister Qin Gang has also agreed to come to Washington to meet with Blinken to further their, you know, conversation on U.S.-China relations. So that's welcome news to the U.S.
How have U.S.-China relationships changed between the Trump administration and now the Biden administration?
Well, good question. The way that I see this is, despite the so many differences between the Biden administration and the Trump administration, if there's one area where Biden basically continue to walk on the path of the Trump administration, it is actually the China policy. There is actually bipartisan consensus emerging in the U.S. that America need to stand up to the Chinese, need to confront China. The game of engagement is now over. So this is actually one area. In a sense, Democrats and Republicans now are actually trying to compete with each other to see who can out-hawk the other, who can sound more assertive, you know, to the Chinese authorities in contrast to the other party. So this is actually one area I see a lot of continuity between the Biden and Trump administrations.
We are talking about U.S.-China relations with Jing Sun from the University of Denver after Antony Blinken, Secretary of State's visit to China to meet with the leader of China, Xi Jinping. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want leaders of both U.S. parties talking tough on China, acting tough? If so, how? Do you see room for cooperation? Join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to listen some more to Secretary of State Blinken talking here about how Taiwan factors into U.S.-China competition and potential cooperation.
Fundamental to us in that is the understanding that any differences regarding Taiwan will be resolved peacefully. That is foundational to how we understand our relationship. And for the past almost five decades, this is an issue that China and the United States have managed responsibly. We remain committed to our One China policy with the three communiques, the Taiwan Relations Act, the six assurances. We do not support Taiwan's independence. We've made clear that we oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo by either side. We've been clear and consistent in our policy, and it's very important that we preserve the status quo that has helped maintain peace and stability across the strait for decades. So I reiterated that to our Chinese counterparts. President Biden has also made that repeatedly clear in his engagements with China.
So this is really a weird situation to me, Jing. China says Taiwan doesn't exist. It's a breakaway part of China. The United States officially says Taiwan, we don't recognize their independence, but Taiwan functions as an independent state, an independent government with its own army, etc. How can we sustain that indefinitely with this sort of like a diplomatic fiction?
Well, I think you raise a really insightful observation. The issue is how we can continue to have this strategic ambiguity over the issue of Taiwan. Like you mentioned, China never, in Beijing's eyes, Taiwan does not exist. It is a part of the People's Republic of China. But what America has done in the past diplomatic communications with China is to say that America acknowledges China's position. So which means we, that's what China says, and we heard what China is saying, but we neither agree nor disagree with the Chinese about whether Taiwan is a part of it. So we have been developing this unofficial, in name only relationship with Taiwan, a very robust network of economic, social, and cultural exchanges with this vibrant democracy over the past three decades. But the problem is, what is the shelf life of this policy? So this is an area, I'm afraid, that despite the statements made by Antony Blinken and despite the statements made by China, that both China and America are sensing some fundamental changes that are happening to US-China, to the issue of Taiwan. And both sides are feeling that time is not on their side. And on some, that they have to be proactive to make some changes happen to advance, to put forward their own national interests. This is where the danger lies.
The big worry, I think, globally is, what if China takes military action to end the de facto independence of Taiwan, invades it? How much does that prospect worry you? How likely do you see that being? Of course, we can't predict the future, but how much does it worry you?
It worries me greatly. Actually, I had multiple conversations off record with Chinese media, friends working for the Chinese media and working for the Chinese government. And I walked away from those interviews feeling very pessimistic. And at least to the people that I talked to in China, the issue is not about whether an invasion will happen. Of course, in Mandarin, they don't call that an invasion. They call it reunification campaign. When, it's not an issue about whether this will happen. It's an issue of when this may happen. So the CIA actually kind of agree with the Chinese sentiment by saying 2027 is a particularly interesting year, vital year that we should be looking at.
Why 2027?
I think this is actually some kind of a math is involved here. So what happens is the People's Republic of China was founded in 1949. So by 2049, China will be celebrating, the PRC will be celebrating its 100th anniversary of the founding of the Republic. Now, China expects, or President Xi expects, in the wake of Chinese invasion of Taiwan, China will face Western isolation and condemnation. There will be widespread severe sanctions imposed on China. But at the same time, he also places bets on if the invasion could go ahead efficiently, if China can take Taiwan in a relatively short time in window. Memory in international relations is notoriously short. So give it another 10 years, 15 years for you gradually the West to quote unquote accept the fact that that Taiwan is solidly in China's pocket, they will have to resume contact with China. So give it another 10 or 15 years for that to happen. And couple that with the Chinese invasion of Taiwan, he still wants a big celebration by 2049 of the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Republic. So that's when the CIA actually reaches the conclusion that somewhere around 2027 to 2030, that's the time window that Beijing could be particularly enticed, so to speak, to invade Taiwan.
We're talking to Jing Sun, professor of political science at the University of Denver, about Secretary of State Antony Blinken's recent diplomatic trip to China. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll look at the economic links and the economic competition between the U.S. and China. What do you want to see from the U.S. government when it comes to our reliance on China for so much of our supply chain? Does your business involve selling things to China or things made in China? What do you want to see from U.S. leadership when it comes to the relationship with China, support from Taiwan? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jing Sun, professor of political science at the University of Denver, telling us about the outcome of Secretary of State Antony Blinken's diplomatic visit to China. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How important is it for the U.S. to have a good relationship with China? Or do you want to see a tougher talk from the White House, from Congress, when it comes to human rights, economic issues, Taiwan, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jing, I'm looking at a list of the biggest economies in the world. The two countries we're talking about, U.S. and China, number one and number two. Can you talk about the economic ties between the two countries, the interdependence, and the competition, too?
Well, when it comes to U.S.-China economic ties, and or you know even broader, wrong China's economic relations with the West, I think both China and leaders in the West are walking on a very tight rope. So on one hand, for both Beijing and for Washington and for leaders in the EU, they're talking about de-risking. They try to somehow reduce their reliance on the other. But on the other hand, they also realize complete decoupling is impossible and could become disastrous to all the parties involved. But this is where actually all the tricky things will begin to unfold when you talk about de-risking rather than decoupling. So where are the issues to be, you know, somehow the two economic entities should depart from each other? Where are the areas where the two will continue to collaborate? This is the rationale makes sense to all the parties involved, but when it comes to the actual execution of this de-risking policy, it's still very foggy.
In the event of a war, say a Chinese reunification campaign, as you said they call it there, or invasion of Taiwan, you mentioned China would expect massive sanctions. How much does China's economy depend on selling stuff to the United States and the EU?
Well, what President Xi has been doing in the past 2 or 3 years is he has been, you know, touring around the country trying to sell this new idea called internal circulation. So this is actually done in the context of in the event that China invades Taiwan and China will be cut off from the West, global, international trade network. So what differentiates China from smaller countries like Japan or South Korea is China has an immense internal market. So she is hoping that by promoting his internal circulation agenda, that China could continue to at least survive in the short run. And then again, he really places bets on his hope that the invasion of Taiwan will be carried out in a relatively efficient manner, that before the world could respond in a more forceful way, Taiwan is already part of China.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Michigan. Tom, hi.
Hi there. Well, one of the questions I've wondered is why the British had to turn over Hong Kong. I mean, the People's Republic of China wasn't formed until 1949. Why did they have to even turn that lease over? And does the turnover of Hong Kong does that put in the Chinese mind like, okay, well, this is one step closer to the unified China, one China idea, and therefore substantiates their move to claim Taiwan?
Gotcha, Tom. You're breaking up a little, but point taken. Jing, China taking back Hong Kong after the British lease expired. Does that mean like next in line in some ways was Taiwan, as Tom I think is saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When China took Hong Kong back in 1997, it was allegedly going to practice one country, two systems, a system that, a formula that we now know has failed miserably. But at the time, when China was selling this imposing one country, two systems formula on Hong Kong, it was doing so not as a way to somehow lure Hong Kong. Hong Kong already became a part of China. It's really as a way to try to persuade the Taiwanese, come and join us. You will continue to maintain your economic and social and political system. All that I want is geographically, you will become a part of China.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom. Since this Blinken visit just yesterday now, President Biden in a campaign event referred to Chinese President Xi Jinping as a dictator. The Chinese government responded unhappily. They called that absurd and irresponsible. Can one comment like that reverse what appeared to be the soothing of the tensions that we saw from the Blinken visit?
Probably not at this point. I think they probably, by just following news coverage in this country, that they know that President Biden has a reputation for saying things that people were not quite expecting him to say on that particular spot, on that particular occasion. And Biden made that remark at a fundraiser event. So Beijing already made its point. It criticized what Biden said as immensely irresponsible. But at the same time, given the momentum that both powers just gained through Anthony Blinken's visit, I feel at least in the short run, we are going to expect some positive movements from both countries.
One point I've seen made is that one thing that we didn't get here was direct military to military communications. So that's in case of planes fly too close to each other or ships sail too close to each other in open waters. There's a risk of tensions escalating, somebody accidentally shooting at somebody else. The idea that we want military leaders to be able to pick up a phone, get in touch right away and tamp things down. How important is that?
It is extremely important, but this is where an area, unfortunately, these two powers are still deadlocked. So what happens is the reason the Chinese refuse to talk to the U.S. military is because the Chinese defense minister right now is under sanction by the U.S. This is the person that while he was, before he became the defense minister, he was in charge of getting weapons for the Chinese military, and he purchased some advanced Russian fighter jets at the time Russia was under Western sanction. So as a result of that, we are putting this person on our sanction list. And later this person was promoted by President Xi to become the defense minister. So for the Chinese, their rationale is they can't talk to to the U.S. when their top soldier is under U.S. Sanction. While for us, for the U.S., America has made it abundantly clear that the sanction per se should not become an obstacle for the two militaries to talk to each other to reduce the possibility of any accidents that happen between the two.
Time for one more caller. Scott is with us in Mequon. Scott, hi.
Hi, yes. One thing, I've been to Taiwan over 20 times in the last 20 years. I spent probably two or three months a year there. One thing that nobody's saying is China controlled Taiwan for, I don't know how long, but up until around 1900. In 1900, right around there, Japan took control of Taiwan, and Japan controlled Taiwan until Chiang Kai-shek fled there from China. So if Taiwan belongs to China, the U.S. belongs to England by that rationale. It's just there's no way it could happen. There's no way they're saying that they control and they used to control. It's been well over 100 years.
Gotcha. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. And Jing, that makes me think, what do we know about what the people in Taiwan think about the idea of a one-child policy?
Well, people in Taiwan are overwhelmingly rejecting China's one country, two systems formula, even before the, you know, is a catastrophic failure in Hong Kong, you know, the mass pro-democracy movement that was suppressed by the Chinese Communist Party. Even before that, only people in the very low single digit, 4%, 3% of the Taiwanese would support Taiwan to be reintegrated into the People's Republic of China under the one country, two systems formula. But at the same time, people who are in favor of outright independence are also in the minority. You have consistently 60%, 70% of the people in Taiwan that are in favor of maintaining the status quo. Basically means Taiwan maintain its de facto independence without announcing formal independence.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Jing, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Jing Sun, professor of political science at the University of Denver, also a UW-Madison alumnus. He joined us to talk about Secretary of State Antony Blinken's recent trip to China, what it means for the future of the international relations between those two countries, and about Taiwan. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, top Wisconsin Republicans are targeting diversity efforts in higher education, including a threat of funding cuts to the University of Wisconsin system. Dig into that issue and share your thoughts. You can get started right now. What do you think? Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk about what infertility is like for men who want to become fathers, look at causes and treatments, and why we don't talk more about men's experiences of infertility. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about noticing the trees.
Sometimes we can take the world's beauty for granted. We don't notice these natural works of wonder that are in front of us every single day, until we do. For writer Catherine Jago, it took a global pandemic to open her eyes to the trees that surrounded her in Madison.
I came to know them during that unreal, anxious first summer of the pandemic, when it seemed that all I did, apart from commando-style grocery shopping and Zoom meetings in my basement, was walk. Morning and evening, I did loops around our residential neighborhood, alone, with my husband, or with friends. One day in June, I stopped short in the street, interrupting my husband's story to ask, "What's that heavenly smell?" Puzzled, because we couldn't see any source for the exquisite, subtle scent, I looked up. A big shade tree spread over us with heart-shaped leaves, and when I looked more closely, sprigs of barely discernible blossom. I pulled one to my nose and inhaled. They smelled like orange blossom and jasmine. The flowers were tiny drooping clusters, the color of champagne, tattered and insubstantial as scraps of antique lace. I went home and looked up the tree. It was a basswood, a type of linden. After that, I saw basswoods and their cousins, the little leaf lindens, on every street. I remembered noticing them before in May, when they drop thousands of papery, pale green wings that pile up, thick as confetti, on the sidewalk. But in my 35 years in Wisconsin, I'd never thought to identify the tree or notice them flowering. On the day before the summer solstice, I paused under a massive linden that enveloped the sidewalk like a perfumed green cave. It was loud with humming every floret being worked by insects. Lindens, I read that week, are sometimes called bee trees because pollinators love them. My favourite local honey has long been basswood with its mild floral sweetness. It also happens that my favourite herbal tea is made from linden leaves and blossoms. It's the tea that Marcel Proust was drinking with his famous Madeleine, the scent that unlocked his memories of lost time. Lindens have long been associated with love, fertility, peace, and healing. In Greek mythology, they were the tree of Aphrodite, the goddess of love and beauty. In Roman, Norse, and Germanic cultures, they symbolized marital love and fidelity. Lindens are so central to some European cultures that the months when they flower are named after them. The word for June in Croatian is lipanj, linden blossom time. The Polish and Ukrainian words for July, lipiec and lipanj, mean the same thing. I felt humbled that I'd only just learned when the lindens flower here in Madison. I think more and more now about the generosity of trees, their beauty, scent, shade, nourishment, their slow wisdom, their endurance. I've begun to think of lindens in relation to the Midwest, calm, not showy, understated, with flowers that are discreet and easy to miss, and also married love, because it's been on my daily walks with my husband that I met these trees. And my appreciation for them and for him and for this place we've made home has only grown and deepened over time.
Catherine Jago is a writer based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Sarah Hopeful was the technical director for this story. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Polling shows that most men want to become dads someday. But when men are having trouble conceiving, there isn't always as much support for them as women who are struggling to become moms. Not even a lot of research on how not being able to become a dad affects men psychologically. A UW infertility expert joins us now to look at the causes and some of the treatments for male infertility. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you or your partner experienced infertility? What was it like? Can you talk about the process of seeking treatment? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Daniel Williams is a professor, a residency program director, and vice chair for education for the Department of Urology at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He specializes in men's infertility and sexual health. Dr. Williams, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks very much for having me today.
How common is infertility for men?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we hear a lot about infertility on the female side and for couples in general. And the, you know, it's about 10 to 15% of couples of reproductive age are faced with fertility every year here in the U.S. And what's interesting about that is that although much of the attention is focused on the female side, you know, as men, we can play a part in this problem as well. Sometimes that problem is overlooked, but upwards of about half the time when couples are being evaluated for fertility issues, we find something on the male side that's going on.
I looked, there's a long list of possible causes of male infertility. What are some of the most common ones?
Yeah, it's a great question. Issues on the male side can range from problems with the production of sperm, problems with the delivery of sperm for where it needs to go. Sometimes we find genetic abnormalities that contribute to fertility issues on the male side. But what we're really looking for when we do these evaluations for the male partner is making sure that there's not anything harmful going on, and also to see if there's something we can identify and treat to help that couple improve their fertility chances.
Yeah, what are some of the things that are potentially harmful to a guy who's experiencing infertility, where this is a symptom of something maybe hazardous?
Yeah, great question. Fortunately, it's quite rare that we find something harmful to that man during a fertility evaluations. But some of the things that we find that could be health threatening or even life threatening would be things like testicular cancer, which overall is quite rare. But sometimes men with testicular cancer present as having fertility problems. And then another relatively rare thing, but potentially concerning thing, would be a brain tumor that affects the man's pituitary gland, which is the hormone control center in our brain. And sometimes we find pituitary problems in men as they present with infertility.
I don't want to worry people. Those are fairly rare, you said.
That's correct. Yeah, it's quite rare that we find these harmful things. But really, much of the focus of the male fertility evaluation is on what the underlying cause or causes are, and if they are things that can be treated.
Now, we see in the news the Robert De Niro's of the world and Al Pacino's of the world becoming dads at a very advanced age, but aging can have impacts on fertility, I understand. What do we see there?
Yes, that's a very important point. It's good to, at some levels, it's sometimes good to see, you know, what's going on in the overall world with fertility, but I think it's more the exception rather than the rule that men of advanced paternal age are looking to have kids. Historically, it was thought that that men can have kids until they're well into their 70s and 80s, which, as we see in some of these high profile folks, is possible. However, if you look at the impact of age and time on male fertility, men's overall fertility declines with age, number one. But number two, which I think is also important to keep in mind, is that the quality of men's sperm it does also decline over time. And what we're trying to figure out in a lot of areas of research is what potential impact advanced paternal age, meaning old men, what effect, if any, that has on the offspring as far as potential genetic abnormalities or health conditions that may be associated with an older man and older sperm.
We're talking about men's experiences with infertility and causes, and coming up maybe some treatments with Dr. Daniel Williams, professor of urology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, an expert in male infertility. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you have a rocky road to fatherhood yourself? Have you undergone infertility treatment and you're willing to share that story with us? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the experiences of men dealing with infertility, the effort to become a dad. Our guest is Dr. Daniel Williams, professor of urology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, an expert in male infertility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you for this really, really needed topic. I was actually, my wife and I were struggling with fertility and found a late adult case of cystic fibrosis that I had already always had. And then that helped my brother and his family and my family have kids through IVF. And I'm wondering how common is that? And is that something that is looked at with male infertility as well?
Interesting, John. Dr. Williams, is that something you've come across?
Absolutely. That's a great question, John. Thank you for bringing that that topic up. So with cystic fibrosis, as you and your family are aware, you need to have two genes of cystic fibrosis to have the disease cystic fibrosis. So there are a number of men and women out there who carry one cystic fibrosis gene, but not the double gene, if you will, to have the disease cystic fibrosis. So a number of men who carry cystic fibrosis genes have certain abnormalities in the reproductive tract that cause blockages. So, for example, the vas deferens tube is the tube that carries the sperm through the reproductive tract. And a lot of men who have cystic fibrosis and who are carriers of cystic fibrosis can be missing those tubes. So their bodies are producing sperm, but they're just trapped inside. And so, as you stated, we can do what are called sperm retrieval procedures to get sperm from the man and use those sperm for treatment with in vitro fertilization. And so for men with that cystic fibrosis condition, there are treatment options most of the time to help them out.
John, thanks a lot for sharing that experience with us. We'll go now to Brooke, also in Eau Claire. Brooke, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
So my significant other, he actually just started testosterone replacement. He's been dealing with low testosterone for quite a while. And they told us not to get pregnant while on testosterone. But I've read some conflicting information, and I wanted to know your suggestions.
Oh, interesting. So links between testosterone use, Dr. Williams, and a sperm production.
Yeah, thank you, Brooke, for that question. This is a very hot topic in the male fertility world and in the men's health world in general. In general, we're starting to see a rise in the number of men who are on testosterone treatments. There are a number of reasons for that. Sometimes it's just more of an awareness of it and a better detection of men with low testosterone. But it's a very, very important notion, the idea of testosterone treatments in men with low testosterone. So when men have low testosterone and symptoms from low testosterone, a lot of men do benefit from raising those levels. But if you give a man one of the number, there are many different types of testosterone treatments, but if you give a man testosterone, it does raise his level of testosterone, and most men do feel better going from low to normal. But one important thing that's oftentimes not discussed is that any external testosterone treatment can and does lower sperm production. And in some men, it lowers it down to zero, completely suppresses it. So if a man does have low testosterone, and depending on what the cause of that low testosterone is, if that man is trying to preserve his fertility, there are other treatments that can boost a man's own production of testosterone to help him feel better and to maintain his sperm production. That's a very good question and something that's not always fully understood by many providers and by folks undergoing these treatments. So thank you for that question.
Thanks for calling in, Brooke. Dr. Williams, we don't often talk about male infertility, as you said, in general. How about the emotional and mental health side of things for the patients you deal with? Is this something that people are even talking about?
Yeah, that's another great point. Thank you, Rob. So the fertility journey for most couples can be quite a stressful one. There can be a lot of highs and lows of the emotional journey of having trouble to get pregnant. The stress of being evaluated, what's found or not found during the evaluations. And kind of stereotypically, it was always thought that, men are tough and they can handle whatever's thrown at them. But we're starting to learn more and more about the emotional impact of a man being diagnosed with fertility problems. We know that, yes, the majority of the time, there is a female factor going on that's affecting a couple's fertility. But about a third of the time, it's solely the man's issue with a problem with the sperm or sperm production. And for a lot of men, that can be a very devastating blow emotionally to them. We do see a number of men develop depression after being diagnosed with infertility issues. We see a number of men who develop sexual dysfunction after they're diagnosed or while they're being evaluated. And for many couples, it puts a significant stress on the couple's emotional well-being and relationships. And so this is something that more and more, we're with just more and more awareness of the male fertility issues that men are and couples are understanding. But yes, it can be quite an emotional time for couples and for men struggling with male fertility.
Dr. Williams, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You bet. A pleasure to be here. And thank you to you and your team, Rob.
That's Dr. Daniel Williams, professor, residency program director, and vice chair for education for the Department of Urology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us today for a look at men's experiences of infertility. Now, a year ago this weekend, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its historic opinion that overturned decades of abortion policy. In Wisconsin, an 1800s-era law took effect, immediately banning effectively all abortions in the state. As Bridget Bowden reports, one year after the Dobbs decision, things look quite a bit different for Wisconsin on both sides of the issue.
On a recent morning near Madison, Planned Parenthood nurse Heather Ellingson is packing up her car. Every week for the last year, she's made the two-hour drive to the Planned Parenthood clinic in Waukegan, Illinois. It normally takes about 2 hours, except when the weather doesn't cooperate.
During the winter, there were some days where, wow, just the weather was a bit brutal.
For Ellingson, making the trip just makes sense.
Because most of these are our patients. So many people, patients from Wisconsin, we see in Waukegan. And had the Dobbs decision not happened, we would have been seeing them here in Wisconsin.
And recent data from Illinois bears that out. The Planned Parenthood clinics there have seen a 54% increase in abortion patients since last summer, many of them coming from other states. And that means another fixture of abortion clinics is also making the trip, protesters.
And so we came from Wisconsin to Illinois to try to reach out to women who are abortion-minded.
That's Anne Franchek of Milwaukee. She's been protesting at abortion clinics for close to 40 years. Now she comes down twice a week with anti-abortion posters and models of fetuses.
And I put this in a baby stroller to make it more real that these are babies.
Jenny Higgins is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison and the director of the Collaborative for Reproductive Equity. She says despite all of the people traveling to states where abortion is still legal, the numbers haven't evened out.
What we've seen is while less restrictive states such as Illinois and Minnesota have seen increases in the number of abortions, those increases do not make up for the decreases in restrictive states such as Wisconsin.
It's too soon to know how the ban is affecting birth rates in the state. But Higgins says when abortion clinics in Appleton and Green Bay closed, they went up, and she expects we'll see the same thing now.
So I can say with a lot of certainty that we will expect slight but significant increases in birth rates in the Wisconsin counties that have lost the most access to care.
Although abortion access has been reduced significantly in the state, not much has changed for some Wisconsinites. Before the ban, Wisconsin had 4 abortion clinics located in Madison, Milwaukee, and Sheboygan. Cheryl Thede is the president of the Options Fund, a group that provides financial assistance for abortion seekers in northwestern Wisconsin. They were already helping people get over the border, she says. What's changed is the pressure on out-of-state clinics.
The states where it's legal now are carrying the burden of people from the other states. Mm-hmm. And so there is a little bit more of a lead time with appointments in Minnesota and Illinois as people from Texas and Louisiana and all sorts of states are traveling.
The future of abortion in Wisconsin may come down to the state Supreme Court, which will now have a liberal majority after Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Janet Protasiewicz was elected to an open seat in April. Matt Sandy is the legislative director of Pro-Life Wisconsin. He remembers celebrating the Dobbs decision a year ago, but doesn't believe anti-abortion work is done.
Yes, we've been abortion-free for a year, but abortion could be coming back in the near future.
Back in the car, Planned Parenthood nurse Heather Ellingson is also looking toward the future, but she hopes abortion access will be restored.
I was present when we had to close our door, and I would like to be there and swing that door right back open and be like, nope, we are ready, waiting. We are capable. We've kept up our skills and welcome our patients right back the very minute.
It's expected the court could take up the abortion case as soon as August. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, chronic wasting disease has been a growing problem for years in Wisconsin's deer herd. Check out the latest news about the spread of the disease and efforts to control it. And there have been air quality problems in communities around Wisconsin, including an ongoing advisory for ozone right now for a lot of the state. It's coming from smoke from Canadian wildfires. Check out the science behind the smoke and what it means for our health. And we want to hear from you. Is this affecting your life, your decisions to go outside? Are you at risk because of poor air quality? Let us know about it. You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation that's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.